Blog Talk Radio.
New eco-fascist system within squalid ghettos.
The WWS was founded by former Nazi and Bilderberg group kingpin Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Its current president emeritus is Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. Betraying his eugenistic fervor, Prince Philip has repeatedly expressed his desire to see large numbers of human beings wiped out by a deadly virus. In the event that I am reincarnated, this is what he says, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation, Philip told Deutsche Press Agentur in August 1988. Philip even bemoaned the fact that medical advances had helped alleviate Sri Lanka's crippling malaria problem in the 1980s, brazenly lamenting the fact that less people would die. Sri Lanka must feed three times as many miles, find three times as many jobs, provide three times the housing, energy, schools, hospitals, and land for settlement in order to maintain the same standards. Little wonder that the natural environment and wildlife in Sri Lanka has suffered. The fact is that the best-intentioned aid programs are at least partially responsible for the problems, he said during the University of Western Ontario speech in July 1983. In the preface of his 1988 book, Down to Earth, Phil spoke of his desire to see humans culled through means of population control. I don't claim to have any special interest in natural history, but as a boy I was made aware of the annual fluctuations in the number of game animals and the need to adjust the cull to the size of the surplus population, he wrote. Prince Philip's brazen bloodlust to see humans culled in large numbers betrays the real agenda behind the WWF's touchy-feely green veneer. The true purpose of this organization is to advocate the arcane, authoritarian, and oppressive pseudoscience of eugenics behind the veil of environmental advocacy.
Right. So I think that pretty much states it all.
Yeah, that says Prince Charles. They have a picture of Prince Charles.
Parasite and current president of the WWF faces austerity in his Aston Martin.
So he's sitting in his nice Aston Martin. I guess he's not going to be one of the ones culled.
Facing austerity. This was kind of interesting, too. Rothschild tells UK to sell bailed out banks at a loss.
That was all the banks that we put all our taxpayer money into.
Yeah. The Rothschilds want to start over again here. Let's see. Government should sell part of its stakes in state-backed lenders Lloyds and Royal Bank of Scotland at a loss to kickstart the disposal process that could see investors pay more at later offerings, a senior Rothschild banker told lawmakers. It's a good strategy to start a disposal program with the first tranche of the lowest price. Young, joint head of equity advisory at Rothschild, said on Tuesday. The loss is worth taking today because it's part of a program, he told the Treasury Select Committee, which is taking evidence on the potential disposal of government stakes in Lloyds and Royal Bank of Scotland. Britain is sitting on a loss of over £25 billion, $40 billion from this £45 billion rescue of RBS and 2008. It also faces a £12 billion loss on Lloyds after pumping in £20 billion to save the business. Young says there it was concern among investors that Royal Bank of Scotland senior management could be hounded out by media and public fury over pay rewards before restoring the bank to health. And RBS chairman Phil Hampton and chief executive Stephen Hester waived their 2011 bonuses after politicians from across the board called on them to refuse the awards. Robert Talbot, chairman of the Association of British Insurers, told the committee he too was worried by the furor that surrounded Hester's pay award, perception of government interference in general. And the company is still susceptible to being run as a political football. That perception is there, he said. Its ability to retain a commercial management team is going to be severely inhibited if they do not believe they are going to receive a significant market rate. Banks Burton has held talks to sell part of its 82% stake in RBS to Abu Dhabi investors through sale was not imminent, sources told Reuters. Now, this is interesting that they want to sell, they want to get, somehow they've managed to screw up the entire National Bank, the Royal Bank of Scotland, which is owned by 82% owned by the government.
I don't know. I don't really understand that.
Well, it appears that they're trying to get these large banks, excuse me, which are also part of the Federal Reserve, all right?
So they should sell them at a loss.
So they should sell these things at a loss.
Yeah,
even though
right.
the taxpayer bailed these bastards out.
Yeah, I don't think that's right.
You know, it's just another damn way of them making getting rid of some debt. This is another one that you know, the Greek banks are in huge trouble.
Mm.
And without a government...
Run on cash.
Yeah, and there's a huge run on the banks. What they're doing is they're hoarding euros, and they're sending their euros out of country into foreign banks, all the Greeks, because the euro's got the only thing that'll have value if they go with their Greek fiat currency. So I want to get that here in a second.
I don't know, it doesn't look like
it.
Without a government for the last 11 days and amid mainstream discussion of a Eurozone exit, the Greek people are realizing that the economic and political system as they know it is rapidly descending into chaos, with massive jobless rates that have forced many into bartering to survive and facing credit destruction across the entirety of the country that has led to shortages of critical supplies like life-saving medicines. Those with any money left at national banks are taking the desperate steps of withdrawing as much of their savings as they can from a banking system on its last legs. That is what it looks like when a populace plagued with uncertainty finally loses trust in the credibility of the country's leadership and financial system. Anxious Greeks, what does it say, have withdrawn as much as 700 million euros.
Or almost $1 billion from the nation's banks since the inconclusive May 6 election. President Papoulias told party leaders yesterday, according to a transcript of the meeting on the presidency's website today. Papoulias said he got the information from the head of the Bank of Greece, the central bank, according to the transcript. That people are there's a run on the banks. And as has been said before, Greece is a canary in the coal mine. Go ahead.
The debt has piled up across Europe and the United States. Like the Greeks, Americans will soon hit a breaking point from which there will be no return. When it does finally happen, you can be assured that your local ATM and banks will be inundated with panicked depositors attempting to take possession of as much of their money as possible. But once the line starts forming, it will be too late. Banks will have no choice but to limit withdrawals and close the doors, even to safe deposit box owners, because they will not have enough cash on hand to meet demand. The choice is simple. Either prepare now and have physical assets in your possession, or join the crowds and hope the government can come up with a solution to the massive outflows that will ensue when the bank run begins. Consider the madness we've seen when people can't get their hands on a Black Friday discount Xbox, a flat-screen TV. Our guess is that any solution the government puts forth to deal with anger and frustration of people who can't access their money will involve something like this.
That's a picture of an
armored tank.
Armored tank, yeah. So anyway, sad but true. Sad but true. We've talked about this one before.
Yeah.
I don't know if we brought this one up. Remember?
Yeah.
She did boxes there. Okay.
Let's play something. What were we going to play?
Yeah. I wanted to play one down the road here, but this was interesting, too. And this is a... The media... media now openly reporting al-Qaeda terrorists are working alongside UN observers in Syria, as videos show the terrorists gathering intel for future strikes. When is a terrorist not a terrorist? When a terrorist was committing acts of terrorism that promote the United States imperialistic agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there's a picture here with a guy who is an al-Qaeda guy working with a blue hat, okay?
That was like UN.
Yeah, it is. The UN.
UN observer, yeah.
Yeah, al-Qaeda flag. The guy's an al-Qaeda supporter.
Girl killed by U.S. drone attack.
Oh, yeah. It's
no, that's so wrong.
Let's see. I've got some. This is a fascinating video that I'd like to play tonight. It's called The Israelification of American Domestic Security. And it's really amazing. This guy did a report by, this is from Russian TV, but the guy's a Jewish reporter. But what he did is he wrote a book on the Israelification and how Israel...
infiltrates it.
No, not so much infiltrates. Well, yeah, partly, but... What it does is it's how over 10,000, something like 9,000 or 10,000 police have been trained by the Israeli police force, okay,
really?
The Israeli military, for domestic terrorism, yeah, in the United States, and it's really a fascinating
report.
Let's
hear this. I think this is important, folks.
Now, we're going to take a look at the in law enforcement in the U.S. and how their role may be changing and their power expanding. We've shown you image after image of police using pepper spray on seemingly peaceful protesters, so pepper spray seems to have become the weapon of choice, but that's just the beginning of what police have in their arsenal these days, thanks to a program out of the Pentagon, one that not very many people know about. Local police are getting their hands on weapons and equipment from the military. The 2011 Department of Defense forked over $500 million worth of military machinery to local police departments. So is the government gearing up for Main Street to rise up? From our New York studio, writing fellow for the National Institute, Max Blumenthal joins us now. Welcome, Max. So pepper spray, as we've seen, is the weapon of choice for police these days, based on the video coming out of these Occupy Wall Street protests. What else is law enforcement getting their hands on these days?
Well, first of all, I'm from the Nation Institute. I have to say that for my funders. But speaking of police funding, police have, as you said, just this year in 2011, received $500 million in surplus military weaponry from the Pentagon, which is authorized through the Pentagon's 1033 program. During the late 70s, Congress passed legislation called Posse Comitatus, barring the military from operating on American soil. And in the early 80s, there was an effort to circumvent that in Congress by arming police with military-grade weaponry. And now we're seeing that play out in the streets. People in the inner city in the U.S. have been experiencing this since the 80s, and now middle-class Americans in the Occupy movement are facing not only pepper spray, but things like the LRAD sound cannon, the long-range acoustic device, which can blast your cranium with 140 decibels, shaking your skull so hard even earplugs won't stop it. And as I reported for Al Akhbar English, this weapon has been tested on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank by the Israeli army. So civilians in the U.S. are now up against basically military-style policing.
It sounds like you are calling this a militarization of the police force. Why is it happening, and what is behind it?
Well, it's been happening since the war on drugs, and what's behind it is a mentality among our police forces, our local police, that views common civilians, protesters, and common criminals, or as common criminals. And as I reported for Al Akhbar English in my piece, The Israelification of American Domestic Security, the former head of the Israeli Shin Bet Intelligence Services, Avi Dichter, who's accused of war crimes against the Palestinians, spoke beside FBI Director Robert Mueller at a police convention, at a convention before 11,000 top law enforcement officers. And after Mueller called Dichter his mentor in counterterrorism, Dichter urged American police to see to view their opponents, those they seek to arrest, as crimi-terrorists. In other words, to blur the line between common criminals and terrorists. So what we're seeing is not only a legal blurring of the lines between criminals, terrorists, and protesters, but something in the mindset of American policing and in their training, in which the civilian population is viewed as a hostile and menacing force that can be acted against with military-grade weaponry.
But why are we seeing this attempt to crack down on everyday civilians? Why are we seeing this overwhelming police response to peaceful protesters? Almost, I mean, you're calling it like this military reaction. It's almost as if we're in a war zone and they're responding to terrorist threats. Why treat civilians like they're terrorists?
There's definitely a fear among, Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, has said that he feared that the Occupy movement would gain too much of a foothold and would continue to expand. And I was there at the raid on Zuccotti Park in downtown New York, and what I saw from the NYPD reminded me of demolitions I've witnessed by the Israeli army and the Israeli border police inside Israel and in the occupied West Bank. And as I reported, there's been, since 9/11, since the war on drugs transferred into the war on terror, 9,000 American police officers have been trained by Israeli security and intelligence officials. Hundreds of top law enforcement officers have gone to Israel to train. And what they're learning there is counter-terror training by a country that has spent 63 years dispossessing and controlling an indigenous population. Now they're bringing that back into the streets in the United States against the civilian population. So you're seeing a process since the war on terror of Israelification. And this is extremely dangerous in terms of what it means for the relationship between civilians and their protection under established civil liberty codes.
Now, Max, who benefits from this militarization of the police force? I know Occupy Wall Street, they would say not the 99%.
Certainly not the 99%, certainly not the police, because police have to do community work. And what we've seen is a counter-terror creep in our local police forces through a program called JTTF, or the Joint Terrorism Task Force, where the FBI and even the CIA are able to come in and dictate to local police forces how they can treat, monitor, and spy on local populations. The NYPD, as I reported and as the Associated Press reported, has set up what it calls a demographics unit. And this is following Police Commissioner Ray Kelly's several trips to Israel, where they've monitored virtually all areas of Muslim life in the United States. So clearly, they've gone beyond protecting civilians. It's not clear exactly who they're guarding, but with respect to the Occupy Wall Street, if you go down there, and if you went down there when the encampment was intact at Zuccotti Park, they were protecting the financial institutions at Wall Street. But at the same time, there's simply an effort by federal law enforcement to take the reins of local law enforcement, to corrupt local law enforcement, destroy the relationship between civilians and the police, and to treat civilians as criminals, if not terrorists, or as Avi Dichter, FBI Director Robert Mueller's so-called mentor, said, crimi-terrorists.
I want to ask you, because in some ways it doesn't really make sense. We've pointed out on RT before that these police officers, they're part of the 99%, so why are they engaging in these hostilities against their neighbors, their friends, their community?
That goes to the mentality of just following orders. I've seen chants during Occupy Wall Street demonstrations at the police asking them to join the protesters, and that's simply impossible. And disregards the position that police are put in. They're basically working people. So what this really goes to, and what I'm trying to show through my reporting, is the mentality of federal law enforcement leaders like FBI Director Robert Mueller and Ray Kelly, who's bragged that he has a weapon that can shoot down a combat jet, of militarizing their police forces and putting police officers who are working people, who are members of local communities, in impossible positions where they have to treat their neighbors as criminals and terrorists or crimi-terrorists. And this demographics unit that I mentioned that the NYPD has set up, and by the way, the NYPD refuses to disclose, the CIA refuses to disclose the name of the former CIA Middle East station chief who is in the senior ranks of the demographics unit. This is the level of coordination. They depend on Muslims in Muslim communities to spy on Palestinian-Americans and Pakistani-Americans.
Thank you so much for, we are out of time, unfortunately, but thank you so much for weighing in. That was Writing Fellow for the Nation Institute, Max Blumenthal.
It was an interesting...
Now, we're going to take a look at the...
It was a very interesting... thing to know that what's happening here, but to me, this article was even more fascinating because this is about the real state of militia. In 14 different states, now the governors have declared that the state militia is not part of the National Guard, but you know,
ongoing argument.
They're there to defend, and this article came out. And the Join the Revolution, Assert Your Rights, theconstitutionguard.com. And it says, 14 state governments under fire from White House for forming citizen militia not under federal control. Right now, this is keeping the New World Order from really rearing its ugly head in an armed population, which is the militia at large. Did you want to read this?
Go ahead, because it's hard for me to read on that black.
The state governors and the state legislatures are within their large right, a legal right, to call up the state militia. The state militia is not the National Guard. The state guard or militias proceeded before the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the U.S. Constitution. And the state defense forces are the not regular army or a professional force. They are unorganized and irregular formations consisting of the people possessing arms, not under a centralized command structure. To prevent such abuses from a centralized government, the Bill of Rights was adopted by the Congress and the original 13 states. The militias and the possession of arms in the hands of decentralized power is the alternative to having a standing army in peacetime. The 10 articles in the Bill of Rights is adopted as expressed by the preamble stating, in order to prevent misconstruction of or abuse of its power, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the benefits or the beneficent ends of its institution. The Bill of Rights is a means to restrain federal power over the sovereign states and their individual. In the Second Amendment, a well-related militia, regulated militia, will be necessary for the security of a free state. And that means it is not the National Guard that only came into existence after the Militia Act of 1903, the Dick Act. And many anti-gun advocates on the left argued that the well-regulated militia means the National Guard, which is supposed to be under the command of the state governors. And the second part of the Second Amendment states, after the comma states, the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That means arms in the hands of the people and not a standing army in peacetime. And the original definition of militia is every able-bodied man and a force not under a centralized government control. And a sheriff posse is the militia at large in his county, consisting of the armed populace under the posse comitatus. And he can call up every armed person to assist him keeping order. This is why, wow, did you know that?
I did know that.
This is why the office of sheriff is being attacked. And the tyrants are working hard trying to get rid of this elected office with an appointed yes man. They took away his office in Connecticut, and now they are trying to get rid of the office in Delaware. Huh. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
I didn't know that.
No.
I always thought sheriffs just deliver papers, basically, now, you know, that kind
not
of thing.
Not in New York State.
But,
see, Connecticut has a whole different system.
Different.
Yeah.
A state guard citizenship militia and sheriff posse that are outside federal control or any centralized power is legal and necessary in the preservation of liberty as an alternative to a standing army. George Washington, who was the commander of the Continental Army that defeated the British, and our first president, said, "Firearms stand next in importance to the Constitution itself. They are the American people's liberty teeth and keystone under independence. And from the hour the Pilgrims landed to the present day, events, occurrences, and tendencies prove that to ensure peace, security, and happiness, the rifle and pistol are equally indispensable. The very atmosphere of firearms everywhere restrains evil interference. They deserve a place of honor with all that is good." That's fascinating, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Washington also went about standing armies. A standing army in peacetime is the bane of liberty. How President Obama is threatening 14 state governors performing state defense forces outside the federal control. These forces are not the state National Guard, which is already federalized. Military formations no longer under the control of the governor and now under the Pentagon command, and the president threatened these governors being tried for treason.
Hmm.
Can you imagine that?
No.
"I do not see an act of treason among the 14 state governors. What they are doing is legal and moral to form state defense forces outside federal control. And President Bush signing the Military Commissions Act and this John Warner Defense Authorization Act that calls for invading states that rebel against federal rule." And adding, in addition, President Bush signed BD-51, which is classified. Even congressional representatives with high-level security clearance cannot even read the document.
Wow.
When President Obama signs the National Defense Authorization Act 212 and the executive order to call the National Resource Defense Preparedness, it is good people are buying firearms, and the state governors are forming state defense forces to stand against tyranny coming out of Washington. And people would rather fight than be arrested without charge to be taken to a FEMA camp. I agree with them fully on that. I can totally see what's happening here. And with Obama trying to ram UN Agenda 21, trying to force people off their land and into compact cities, to shut down family farms and any small industry outside the crony capitalism, President Obama thinks he is a law unto himself. He will not succeed lording over America as a dictator. He can try to put TSA on interstates and in shopping malls. If the president thinks he can deploy NORTHCOM troops to state capitals to overthrow sovereign states that nullify the dictator's decree, might be Obama's downfall, showing the nation for what he really is: an arrogant, despotic tyrant and a narcissist that needs to be removed, or our nation falls into darkness. And the state governors forming defense forces outside centralized federal control is constitutional and legal. It is their moral obligation to protect the state and the people from tyranny. It is the duty of the people to resist tyranny as a moral obligation. When the sheriff or governor calls them up in defense of the state, when it is immoral and right, the only act of treason is the imposter in the White House imposing his agenda alien to the people. That is illegal and unconstitutional. To arrest the governor and send the military to invade the states, not only along with Obama's illegal decrees asserting state rights, if he dares try it, there might be very harsh consequences he never anticipated that will be his demise. Pray for your state governors who are standing up to the federal government so they have the courage to do what is right. They can use all the help they can get. I thought that was fascinating. And I think it's right. You know, I really do. You know, you shoot the bastards before they come and get you. You got to, you know, because it's all over. You know what I mean?
Well,
You'll never get out of there. Yeah. Think about it. If the country is suddenly under martial law, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you have no rights. They can come in, pick you up for anything.
Well, actually, we have no rights now.
Yeah, but they're still
they just
courts.
Not aren't
they're
exercised.
Still courts. There's
yeah.
still chances to get out of there.
Not
but
much
now,
if they want
well, you know, then I'd get your gun and run, babe. because that's basically where you're going to head. I mean, you're going to be head first in Guantanamo or something worse, right, for the rest of your days, because you're such an outspoken liberal mind. Huh? You don't mind? You don't mind going to jail?
Well, I do mind. I don't want to go.
Would you mind going?
Yes, of course I would mind.
They just grab you right out of here.
Well, of course I would mind. I wouldn't like it. I'd be scared, and I wouldn't want to go.
And if you could shoot the guy and run away,
no,
would you?
I would. No.
Why not?
Well, I can't use the gun, and I don't want to.
Well, what if it's used against you? You just stand
there
and go,
okay. There's nothing I can do about that, Leo.
No, you die.
Well, I guess that's the way it would be then. I'm not going to shoot
somebody. Because you are such a martyr.
No.
Oh, you would martyr your life for some bow-legged, bull-horned moron.
I don't believe in using violence.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I do, because when it comes down
I believe in what Gandhi did. I believe in what Martin Luther King did.
Yeah, but you know, Martin Luther King, all right, got shot, and so did almost all of his guys. So all of his leaders got shot. Okay, and then Gandhi got shot, and so did all of his followers get shot. Okay, and hundreds of thousands of people in India. We're marching with Gandhi and got beat over the head and got killed and got, you know, yeah. So, and what? And it wasn't until those people got pissed off and started going after the governments and going after their leaders.
In the different provinces.
Not non-violently, with violence, okay? You know, and beating the hell out of these guys and killing them. That's when there was a revolution. Gandhi was a big hootie booty, you know, booga booga, you know. He did all this great stuff, yeah. But it was the same with Martin Luther King. He did all this stuff. He was a leader. But it was the threat of the Pink Panthers. It was the burning down of Watts. It was the complete and utter race riots, okay, that shook Kennedy.
Not the Pink Panthers, the Black Panthers.
Did I say Black Panthers?
You said Pink.
Oh, I did. Sorry.
I think
Pink Panthers.
I'm thinking
right,
Pink.
Right.
It wasn't a Pink Panther or a movie or something?
But it was the threat of violence. And the violence, okay, that was occurring in 1968.
Well, I think people discovered the power of number.
Well, yeah, the power of number, but also the power of anger. All right?
And when you're being together.
You know, and those people were damn pissed off. And
there's many more of us than there.
But if we're all on fluoridated water and, you know, psychotropic drugs and cell phones and, you know, ear cancer and, you know, all of this stuff, there's not, you know, you just come and get you, you're going to die in a year anyway. So it's like, but,
okay,
you know,
let's move on to our audio. That's your opinion,
Leo. I'm proud of these militia.
Let's move on to the audio that we have.
Okay. I wanted to read this
because we wouldn't have time. To play it.
This thing on Venezuela was
we can come back to that.
Let's see what I got here. Homelessness and despair in New York City. Be right there in a second. Yeah, this is by Global Research.
Yeah, they always have good articles. You don't have the audio?
There is one, but it was 23 minutes long, and I really didn't want to get into it.
The number of homeless people on the streets of New York City increased by 23% in 1 year, according to an annual survey conducted by the city's Department of Homeless Services. On January 30th, volunteers for the organization counted an estimated 3,262 people living on the streets, a 23% increase from 2011. The 2,925 volunteers walked approximately 15,000 miles while surveying the city. The largest number of homeless people living on the streets were found in Manhattan and Brooklyn. About half of the total number of people accounted for in the survey were living inside the city's subway system. When the results of the survey were released last month, Homeless Service Commissioner Seth Diamond said in a statement that the greatest challenge facing the agency is finding more housing options for people without homes. In a cynical attempt to limit press coverage of the survey, the agency released the data late on Friday afternoon. This was in stark contrast to a year earlier when the city survey had shown a 30% decrease in the street homeless population since 2008. The results for that survey were announced with great fanfare, complete with an elaborate news conference.
The homeless people and Linda Gibbs, Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services.
While the latest survey shows a significant increase in street homelessness, advocates for the homeless believe that the actual number of people sleeping rough in the city is much higher and have criticized the survey for failing to count large numbers of homeless individuals, especially those sleeping in non-visible areas like abandoned buildings or alleyways. The Department of Homeless Services itself acknowledges that it only surveys a portion of the city's surface area, about 20%, and only a portion of subway stations. While many homeless individuals sleep on subway trains, particularly in winter months, the agency does not survey the subway trains themselves. In 2007, a study by researchers at Columbia University and New York University showed that 32% of the unsheltered homeless people in Manhattan slept in non-visible places. Nearly half of unsheltered individuals in other boroughs slept in non-visible places. The Department of Homeless Services has been criticized for refusing to reveal how many homeless people are actually counted and for failing to adjust for survey error.
The New York-based advocacy group Coalition for Homeless, which has frequently criticized the city's annual street homelessness survey, cast doubt on the city's findings when they were released last month. Today's release of city street homeless survey estimates a 23% increase. Sadly, this estimate underestimates the severity of the problem given the city's survey consistently, especially the record numbers of homeless children. Last November, the Coalition for Homeless released a report documenting how New York City's homeless shelter population had grown over 41,000 people, including 17,000 children. By the end of October 2011, the highest number ever recorded. According to that report, homeless families are staying in the municipal center shelter system for longer periods, and the percentage of families entering the shelter system who have been homeless before has nearly doubled since 2005, when Mayor Bloomberg ended permanent housing programs for the homeless. While Bloomberg set a goal in 2004 of reducing both the number of people who sleep on the street from the use of the shelter system by two-thirds by 2009, the report released by the Coalition for the Homeless last November found that the total homeless shelter population was 33% higher than when Mayor Bloomberg took office. And the number of homeless families was 45% higher.
Over the years, New York billionaire mayor has repeatedly demonstrated his indifference to the plight of the city's homeless population and his contempt for the working class as it has been battered by financial crises unleashed by Wall Street. Refusing to implement any initiatives to address the underlying cause of homelessness such as poverty, housing costs, unemployment, and mental illness, Bloomberg's policies have been directed entirely towards forcing homeless individuals off the streets and out of sight. Last spring, the city eliminated the Advantage Rent subsidy after it lost state funding for the program. The program was for low-wage workers who had to pay 30 to 40% of their income for housing, with the subsidy making up the rest. Advocates for the homeless warned of a spike in homelessness after Bloomberg's administration immediately stopped admitting new participants. Their warnings proved correct. The Coalition for the Homeless report released last November showed a 10% increase in the number of children in the shelter system between May and October of 2011.
Last year, the Bloomberg administration It also proposed a new policy of asking single adults seeking space in homeless shelters to prove they had no alternative housing, in what was clearly a reactionary attempt to discourage homeless individuals from seeking spaces in the city shelters. However, last February, a state Supreme Court judge ruled that the administration could not impose the new regulations, siding with the city council, which had filed a lawsuit to block their implementation. In another
federal attempt to limit the number of people in the city shelters, the administration considered a plan earlier this year that would have required single adults currently living in shelters to return to their last place of residence. In return, the city would have offered furniture and possibly food stamps to residents who agreed to take the individuals back. According to the proposed policy, if homeless single adults did not return to their former location, they would have been forcibly removed by an officer before becoming eligible for the shelter again. And if family members or friends had refused to take the individuals, homeless shelters would have had the authority to deny them space. Bloomberg released a budget earlier this month that includes a proposal to cut 160 of the city's youth shelter beds in order to save $7 million. This is despite the fact that there are only 250 youth shelter beds available in the city with an estimated 4,000 homeless youth.
Oh, my God. You got it, brutal, man. I mean, this is, but yet... he keeps getting elected. No?
Good question.
Can you explain that to me? I don't understand.
He belongs to the party givers.
Yeah.
He's the one, he belongs to the, he's part of the people who are in charge.
Let's see if I got a... Petrol prices drive UK drivers off the road. That's how much that they've gone up like 85% over there. A recent survey has shown that nearly 40% of British drivers are ready to give up motoring entirely if pump petrol prices continue to rise at the same rate they have over the last year.
Oh, boy.
40%. A survey carried out by a British car evaluation company, Glass Company UK, has revealed that 85% of British drivers are to change their lifestyles due to the continuing increase in the price of petrol in Britain. A survey revealed that over 2% of the drivers polled believe the price of petrol in Britain is reasonable, and as many as 38% of the British drivers, 38%, said the prices would drive them off the roads as they prefer to give up driving. And,
Really? Yeah,
interesting. They just can't afford it. Well, you can understand it. It's $7-$8 a gallon.
Yeah.
Let's see. Belfast Telegraph said the increase of between 14p, I guess, and 15p a litre over the last 12 months has cost British people to spend 10% less on food at supermarkets and 7% less on clothes. This research demonstrates that Brits are reaching breaking point when it comes to petrol and diesel prices. Even a small rise will have a significant impact on the majority of motorists. We're the same here, you know. You know, 10 cents a gallon is a lot of, you know, for somebody spending, you know.
Well, they voted against it in one spot. You know, people, oh, never mind. I was thinking about something else. That's all right. Go ahead.
Voted against what? Gas?
Well, that's sad. Man sets himself on fire outside Breckenridge trial. I mean, people are so desperate.
It's so sad. And a Norwegian citizen of foreign origin tried to enter the building being set on fire outside the court in Oslo.
That whole thing is very sad.
That was that massacre, I guess.
Yeah, terrible.
There was another good article that I wanted to read before. We got about 10 minutes left. A global crime spree. What's NATO ever done? This is about NATO and the summit coming up, and what actually
the GA?
Yeah, it's not that long, but it's a good article. Wondering why anyone would confront NATO's summit in Chicago this month? A look at some of its more well-known crimes might spark some indignation. Desecration of corpses, indiscriminate attacks, bombing of Allied troops, torture of prisoners, unaccountable drones are a few of NATO's outrages in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, and elsewhere. On March 20, 2012, Pakistani lawmakers demanded an end to all NATO CIA drone strikes against their territory. As reported in the New York Times, Pakistan's forces, Foreign Secretary said April 26 to 12, we consider drones illegal, counterproductive, and accordingly unacceptable. Afghan President Karzai on the 31st of May, on May 31st last year, gave what he called his last warning against NATO bombing of Afghani homes, saying they continue their attacks on our houses. History shows that Afghans do with trespassers and with occupiers. And while bombing Syria, Libya last March, NATO refused to aid the troops of 72 migrants adrift in the Mediterranean, and only 9 people on board survived. The refusal was condemned as criminal by the Council of Europe, a human rights watchdog. And NATO set jets, bombs, and rockets at a Pakistani military base for 2 hours on November 26. The Salalah incident killing 26 Pakistanis and wounding dozens more. And NATO refuses to apologize. The Pakistani regime has kept military supply routes into Afghanistan closed since November. And the British military medical journal Lancet reported that the U.S.-led unprovoked 2003 bombing, invasion, and military takeover of Iraq, which NATO officially joined in 2004 in a training capacity, had resulted in over 665,000 civilian deaths. Imagine that?
No,
I can't. By 2006, and 200,000 in the UN-authorized 1991 Desert Storm massacre. Right, so it's over a million people in the Middle East here have been killed by our stupid wars, as civilians.
Yeah.
And April 1999, NATO attacked the railway bridge and the Gulaga Gorge and River, and two laser-guided bombs. At the time, a 5-car passenger train was crossing the bridge and was hit by both bombs.
And that was the end of that.
Yeah. Amnesty International Human Rights Watch accused NATO of violating binding laws that require distinction, discrimination, and whatnot. Well, I remember Wesley Clark, was the general, was the supreme commander of NATO, authorized a missile strike against a broadcast tower, okay, in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And he said that was perfectly fine. Well, NATO rocketed the central studio of radio, there it is, right there, okay? Rocketed the central studio of radio in Belgrade, the state-owned broadcasting corps in 1999 during the Kosovo War, and 16 civilian employees were killed and 16 wounded when destroyed the building. Remember that?
Yep.
We read it on the air.
Yep.
That
was sad.
Amnesty International reported the building could not be considered military, that NATO had violated the prohibition on attacking civilian objects and had become and therefore committed a war crime, which they were never charged for. So, it just goes on and on and on. It's just flabbergasting how we can get away with this kind of brutality, and not be called to trial on it, Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Let's see, what else have I got here?
There must be a short little audio that we can watch.
Yeah, it's got to be something.
We'll go to the next page.
Okay, folks, just give me a bear 1 second here, and I'll try to find some neat thing we can go out on. This is just frightening, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, God. Cool.
Alien invasion. Let's play that.
it's kind of weird.
Yeah, well, I'd like to hear it.
All right. Well, we will get to that. You really want to hear about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Do you want to hear about the manufactured Antichrist?
No, I want to hear about the alien invasion.
Yeah, it's really sick. Okay.
Put it on.
All right. This is Stuart Swerdlow.
Oversoul.matrix presents.
Yeah. The staged alien invasion.
The reptilian society is very structured, and there is a hierarchy where we have the elite group, which is the white-winged reptilians. They're very tall, actually have icy blue eyes, and very sleek but powerful bodies. And then it works down all the way, seven levels, in at least the Draco Empire, to a workforce or drone-like reptilians, which are quite small, perhaps 3 or 4 feet high, very brown, scaly skin, not very intelligent, basically do what they are told. In between, you have a military class, you have a spiritual or religious leaders that are very much like we would have bishops and cardinals and popes. They also have an intellectual caste, and then a general mass of people. For all intents and purposes, if you really wanted to know what the Draco Empire hierarchy was like, just look at the Hindu caste system, which was based on that. If you read about Hindu legend and even anything in East Asia, it talks about the Naga, which were the seven-headed reptilians, which came ashore in Asia after their continent sank in the Pacific and was spoken about in all of the Asian, Southern Asian, and East Asian legends and histories. The seven-headed reptilian, or Naga, really represents the seven levels of the caste system in the Draco Empire hierarchy. The first time I ever had contact with reptilian beings was when I was working as a teenager, believe it or not, in the Montauk Project between 1970 and 1983. They were what I would consider to be of the military or warrior class, very large, powerful, mean-looking, scary-looking. When you're 13, 14 years old and you see an 8 or 9 foot tall creature with fangs and green and yellow eyes coming at you, it's very scary. They were kind of there as observers, along with observers from the U.S. government, the Israelis, the Russians, Germans, and even British. They were there to watch and exchange information on the programming techniques and the technology that the U.S. government had developed from other alien technologies, as well as what they had discovered from Atlantean technologies, which were discovered underneath the Montauk Point. My concerns about the future, as far as reptilians are concerned, is that the information that will be presented to the public about them will not be accurate. I know that the U.S. government and basically the world government is preparing to unleash a staged alien invasion on the planet, meaning they will use the Blue Beam Project, which is holographic technology, which can be picked up on radar and actually heard and felt by those on the surface, of alien beings or at least vehicles attacking this planet. They can even have satellites shoot laser beams or other types of weapons onto the surface to make it look like the Earth is actually being attacked. And people, of course, won't know whether it's true or not, but most people, I feel, will think it's true. Then they will have reptilian beings come and become the savior race, chase away this invading force, which, as we have seen in the last couple of years, there's been meteorites, comets, other space debris, even ELF transmissions that have been bombarding the Earth and passing by the Earth, and scientists say they didn't see it coming, they didn't know where it came from. It'll then be revealed that the attacking race was hurling these objects at the planet as a weapon. And so the reptilians will chase them away. They will be hailed as saviors. Then they will have information saying that human beings on the Earth having reptilian DNA are actually descendants of the savior race, so we are related. They're like the mommy and daddy race of human beings, which in effect is true, but not in the way that it will be presented to the Earth. And then they will have a staged second coming of Christ, who will say that this is his new holy empire and that we should welcome these races. And that is why the Vatican in recent weeks and months has stated that aliens or extraterrestrials are our brothers in Christ, and we should accept them and embrace them. This is all preparation for what the government has in store for humanity.
Oh, boy. Doesn't make you feel
great
promise about the future, does it?
Yeah. So we just ran out of time, but it's a lifetime. But I want to thank everybody who joined us, and hope you got something out of tonight.
That was an interesting last thing. I know you weren't enthused by it, but I wanted to hear it.
I watched it before, and I said, oh, okay. But the fact
thank you for playing it.
The fact that they had Montauk on there.
I was interested in that part.
And they showed, there was another one, the Montauk trailer, the movie, and actor Preston Nichols is in that, where he did a job on covering the entire Montauk thing, what happened down there, and reptilians, and he talks about seeing a reptile, you know.
I remember he told me.
Yeah, yeah, it was pretty frightening.
Very scary. So, but thanks, folks, for listening, and stay tuned tomorrow night for Leo. I'll be off, and then we'll be on again
Friday night with George.
Yes. Okay.
All right. So, good night,
folks.